Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Tuesday, January 21st, 2014. For President Obama, the left lawn keeps on working.
Can't touch this. Can't touch this. Can't touch this. Can't touch this.
The NSA is untouchable. The president made some very minor cosmetic changes to massive spying programs. And over the weekend, the corporate media declared that reform is underway. And I found actually very little coverage. And none of it challenges the president or calls him out for what he omitted. And just how flimsy the limited promises he's made for reform actually are. And as I look back now a few days later, I see all this as an exercise in perception management. The president's been candid about this. He said his job is to get the American people to feel more comfortable with the spying, not to make us more comfortable by reining in the spying and making it legal and constitutional. And based on the early accounts, it's working quite well for the president, and I'm very sorry to say that. We'll get to some poll numbers in a moment. But, you know, true to form, the New York Times took the very limited reform proposals that the president articulated on Friday and put them into a box. Yes, a display box. So it says, Obama's changes to government surveillance. Item 1, phone records. Obama says he wants to find a way not to have the government collect records in bulk, but rather to keep them in private hands. That means he wants to continue to collect our telephone records, despite his handpicked panel telling him, really not worthwhile. Despite Judge Richard Leon's blistering ruling at the federal court level, the district court level? Nope. The president will continue with modest changes. He's going to require FISA court permission for each search of collected telephone metadata. But the court remains secret. And while he's appointing an advocate who will appear there on certain occasions, it's the secrecy that is the problem. In my view, you cannot have a legitimate court proceeding if it's done in secret, if there's secret evidence, if the ruling is kept secret. Then they list emails and phone calls. Obama said he would ask the Attorney General and Director of National Intelligence to come up with ideas for additional restrictions on the government's ability to retain, search, and use communications of Americans that were incidentally collected. Now, what a pile of weasel words is that? He's going to ask them to make some recommendations. There is no commitment here that any of them will actually be put into effect. And we're supposed to just say, well, yeah, it's Obama. He's not evil. So we can trust him, right? Let's just go along with this. National security letters. Well, Obama's going to reduce the length of the gag order on, say, a librarian who gets an NSL, requiring him or her to disclose what books I've taken out. But no mention of requiring a court's permission. And on down the line here, I mean, the president was very skillful in the deception that I feel is the ultimate impact of his speech. And the polls show that Americans are either bored with this, passively accept it, say there's nothing I can do about it. But according to a Pew Center research poll, much of the public has paid little attention to the details of this policy debate over government surveillance. Only 8% of those surveyed said they'd heard a lot about Obama's plans for new restrictions, they call it, on the National Security Agency. 1 in 5, well, that's 20%, said Obama's plans would increase the protection of individual privacy. 1 in 8, what's that, about 12%, said it would make fighting terrorism more difficult. Now, those are not strongly held views in any case, whichever side you want to take there. Now, while based on a comparison to a Pew poll last July, 5% more Americans say they disapprove of the government's collection of telephone and internet data as part of anti-terrorism efforts. So that's a modest improvement, and it's slightly encouraging. But a lot of the disapproval is partisan. Republicans who say they consider themselves Tea Party supporters are particularly negative, disapproving of NSA surveillance 68% to 27%. Americans younger than age 30 are particularly likely to disapprove of what NSA does. But that means there are all kinds of Democrats who are accepting the left lawn. And if you're new to the Peter B. Collins Show, I have explained that Reagan was the Teflon president, and DuPont developed the new and improved left lawn for Obama because nothing sticks from his left. Nothing. And this is curious. Asked about Edward Snowden, Americans offer somewhat contradictory opinions. The public is almost equally divided on the question of whether he has served or harmed the public interest. Americans younger than 30 are significantly more inclined to see his actions positively, while those over 65 see them negatively. By 56% to 32%, Americans say they think the government should pursue a criminal case against Snowden. Even those who say they disapproved of the NSA's surveillance programs split evenly on the question of whether Snowden should be prosecuted. And so, as we head into this midterm election year, the president has set a very low bar for any meaningful reform to the mass surveillance of Americans in the United States. And with polls like this, members of Congress are not going to stick their neck out, or their necks, on controversial issues when they feel they could end up being painted as soft on terrorism. This does not bode well for any serious effort to return to constitutional rule in this country. And on the very day that Obama gives this speech and signals that, oh, you know, we're going to make some changes here, his Justice Department notified the ACLU that it was going to continue to withhold many records, including decisions by the FISA court, from a Freedom of Information Act suit brought by the ACLU, focused on bulk surveillance activities under Section 215 of the Patriot Act. And the lawsuit has resulted in a trove of documents from the so-called FISA court detailing the scope, authorizations, and in some cases, violations surrounding NSA surveillance. These are some of the disclosures that Obama took credit for on Friday that were only driven by court orders, not voluntary disclosure or declassification by the administration or the NSA or the FISA court. And among the information disclosed in 24 documents released late on Friday, they go all the way back to 2006, which is when the court first got requests to legalize the illegal wiretapping that Bush had conducted before then. There's a footnote that curiously says that the court understands that NSA expects it will continue to provide on average approximately 3 telephone numbers per day to the FBI. And the reporter who wrote the article that I'm referring to, which is from the Guardian newspaper, and it's Spencer Ackerman, formerly a Wired reporter, he says, if true, the estimate suggests the NSA has given the FBI about 13,000 phone numbers over the last 12 years. What are they doing with those numbers? Well, this suggests that there is another massive data collection program. 12,000 isn't as massive as millions of phone records. I do understand that, but it's still not isolated or narrowly targeted. And the U.S. attorney, in refusing to disclose any more to ACLU, says the government can't specify the total number of documents withheld because the number itself is classified. Yes, secrets about secrets. And that's what they're tripping over or tripping on. And Alexander Abdo, an attorney for ACLU, quote, it appears that the government is concealing the existence of other bulk collection programs under the Patriot Act. In other words, on the same day that Obama recognized the need for a vigorous debate about bulk collection, the government appears to be hiding the ball. We can't have the public debate that President Obama wants without the facts that his agencies are hiding. Well put, Mr. Abdo. I'm grateful to the people who support this program, and I know many of you share my desire to fight against intrusive government spying. And I want to thank people who've recently renewed their annual subscriptions and pumped $50 into the Peter B. Collins podcast account. Over in France, Gaël Lagar. Here in the United States, Bob Getzla. Also, Mark Brodsky, Eric Prahl, and many others have recently renewed. Now, some people have not renewed their annual subscriptions, and that puts a hole in my cash flow. And I don't guilt people or, you know, I'm not going to chase you if you decide to cancel. That is well within your rights, and I thank you for your support in the past. But it means that there are opportunities for others to step in and help support this important effort that I undertake. Will you? Go to my website, peterbcollins.com. Under my mugshot on the upper left-hand corner, there's a link that says sign up. You follow that. You get to choose $5 a month, $10, $20, whatever you're comfortable with. You can cancel any time. Our best deal is the $50 annual subscription. And I am awaiting the arrival of another big shipment of kick-ass Kona coffee, provided by Russ Archibald on the big island of Hawaii. And that's your reward if you're a new annual subscriber, along with a bonus book, and next week we'll announce our new bonus CD offer. Yeah, we try to make it interesting for you. So please, help out to the extent that you can at peterbcollins.com. Now, while you're there on the left-hand side of the page, whether you decide to subscribe or not, there's a vertical ad for audible.com. You click on that. Go over to Audible, sign up for a free 30-day trial. Elizabeth Ferrari did it. She said it was pretty cool. Thank you, Elizabeth. At any rate, when you sign up for that free trial, Audible gives you your first audiobook download absolutely free. Cancel within 30 days, you don't owe them a penny. No matter what you do, they're going to pay me $15 because you tried Audible.com. It's all transparent, right out in the open, and I would appreciate your help. Well, speaking of transparent, one of the things that has bothered me for a long time, and I've used this comparison before, opposite me in my secret studio is a big metal file cabinet, a four drawer. It's covered with bumper stickers from political campaigns. If the FBI, the government, anybody, local cops, they want to get into that file cabinet, they need a warrant. My smartphone actually has more useful information than what is currently stored in that file cabinet. But if I'm pulled over for a taillight out or a 5 mile over speed limit beef, or if I go through an airport and blink too many times, they can grab my cell phone and look at anything on it. Copy the email addresses, read my emails, look for porn, that's happened to some people. Well, finally, the Supreme Court on Friday agreed to hear a pair of cases about whether the police need a warrant to search our cell phones. And one of the cases comes here from here in California, and it is not a trivial case. A guy named David Riley was pulled over for an expired license plate. The police found loaded guns in the car. Then when they looked at David Riley's smartphone, entries that they connected with a street gang. They did a deeper search of the phone, led to information that linked Riley to a shooting. He was later convicted of attempted murder and sentenced to 15 years to life. Now, I don't know enough about Riley's case to say that without the evidence from his phone, he would never have been convicted. But it makes a material difference in his case. There are many other examples of abuse of people's constitutional right to be free from unlawful search without probable cause. And a traffic stop is not probable cause. And a traffic stop is what was used to try to serve papers, legal papers, on Roger Shuler, our colleague and the blogger whose incarceration in Shelby County, Alabama, hits 90 days this week. 90 days Roger's been behind bars. And the litany of injustices in his case we have covered in great detail in the past. And I keep hoping that I'll wake up and see a Facebook post from Carol Shuler that Roger has been released from the Shelby County lockup. There was an encouraging decision. I want to emphasize that it cannot help Shuler, at least not in the short term. This decision came from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, based here in San Francisco. And they have said that a blogger is protected by the First Amendment. And this case here involves a blogger named Crystal Cox. And she wrote posts on her blog about Obsidian Finance Group. She accused them of fraud, corruption, and other misconduct. Now, what's amazing here is that the facts in the case of Crystal Cox are much weaker than in the case of Roger Shuler. For example, the court said that Crystal Cox has a history of making allegations and then seeking payoffs in exchange for retraction. Roger Shuler has never done anything like that, and nothing like that has remotely been placed as an accusation against him. Now, like Shuler, Crystal Cox represented herself at trial. Like Shuler, she got hammered by the court. They ordered her to pay $2.5 million in damages, and then she appealed. And she has not contested the jury's finding that her post was false and damaged reputations. But libel law requires a showing that she acted with negligence, that she knew something was false and published it anyway. And that is a very high standard that has to be met and has not been met in the case of Roger Shuler in the kangaroo courts of Alabama. And for those of you who don't follow all the legal mumbo-jumbo, the reason that this appeals decision from the Ninth Circuit in San Francisco doesn't apply to Shuler is that it is only a precedent in the Ninth Circuit. My understanding is it would have to be ruled on by the Supreme Court to become a precedent that would also apply in Alabama in the Shuler case. The Electronic Frontier Foundation, in a report published on January 14th, notes that the unmanned aerial drones, the Predators, that are used by Customs and Border Protection, also known as CBP, and that's an offshoot of Homeland Security, has logged an eightfold increase in drone surveillance that it conducts for other agencies. So, our dollars are being used and some authorization has been given to use drones over the border with Mexico. And I think that's legitimate. But the mission creep here is that over 700 times, those drones have been diverted to use for other law enforcement purposes. And that is a full 200 more occasions than CBP previously reported to the court in this lawsuit brought by EFF. And so, who are the other agencies? The FBI, U.S. Marshals, Coast Guard, DEA, North Dakota Bureau of Criminal Investigation, North Dakota National Guard, Texas Department of Public Safety. And to my knowledge, there is no mechanism where the Texas Department of Public Safety makes an application to Homeland Security saying, can we borrow your drones on Saturday? And so this is a whole area that is uncharted and appears to be lawless. And technically, they may not be breaking any laws because there aren't any laws that govern this. But this is the kind of mission creep that starts under the guise of national security, anti-terrorism, securing the borders. And the next thing you know, you're Dianne Feinstein and there's a code pink drone flying right up your nose. It is comic in a tragic sort of way. To some international stories today, there are peace talks related to the war in Syria scheduled to take place in Montreux, Switzerland, starting tomorrow. And at the very last minute, the UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon invited Iran, which didn't particularly want to attend, and then uninvited them after a firestorm of criticism from the United States and from the fragile coalition of the so-called rebels in Syria. And the real issue here is that even today, it's unclear if meaningful representatives of the so-called rebels will appear. And they're proxies for Saudi Arabia, the Emirates, Jihadi of the Month. There are Turkish mercenaries and fighters in Syria. It's a real alphabet soup of people with arms. And nobody is really expecting much to come of these talks. There isn't even a serious proposal for a long-term ceasefire and talks leading to some end to the civil war. So we'll watch this for you, but don't expect much to come from Montreux. It's a great place for jazz. I don't know if it's such a great place for peace, at least not right now. Meanwhile, Iran has begun to honor this interim agreement that 16 Democrats in the United States Senate don't really support because they want to impose more sanctions on Iran to make them do our bidding. Well, the centrifuges are being idled. 20% enriched uranium is going to be diluted to 5%. Iran unplugged banks of centrifuges. UN inspectors have arrived. And so, from all accounts, and, I'm not a fool, Iran could be playing quite a sophisticated game here. But it does appear that Iran is honoring the terms of the interim agreement. And I think we need to get some trigger-happy members of the Senate, particularly those Democrats, to politely sit down and shut the fuck up. President Obama gave an interesting interview that showed up in the New Yorker magazine under the byline of its editor, David Remnick. Haven't had a chance to read it yet. I used to subscribe to the New Yorker, but when Seymour Hersh's work stopped showing up there, I stopped the subscription in a kind of personal protest. But what Obama said was essentially that alcohol is more harmful than marijuana. And I want to share with you a response from one of the national leaders in the legal cannabis movement, Steve DeAngelo of the Harborside Health Center in Oakland, one of the largest and also biggest targets for its distribution of medical marijuana, which is legal under California law. DeAngelo, quote, President Obama's belated acknowledgement that cannabis has a less harmful impact on its users than alcohol deserves applause. After all, with that one statement, he has shown more courage on the issue than any president since Jimmy Carter, who famously said that the punishment for a crime should not be more harmful than the crime itself. And D'Angelo goes on, many believe that only Congress has the power to change federal cannabis law, but the fact of the matter is the president has authority to take several immediate steps. One, order the DEA to reschedule cannabis from Schedule 1 to a lower and more appropriate schedule, which would dramatically reduce or eliminate federal prison sentences for cannabis. That's right, Obama, you could do that today. Next, prohibit federal grants to state and local law enforcement agencies from being used for cannabis enforcement, except for sales to minors, use of weapons, and cartel involvement. Next, order all U.S. attorneys to make all current and future prosecutions for cannabis crimes the very lowest priority of their offices. Order an end to the denial of federal benefits due to cannabis arrests or convictions. Order NIDA to fund research into the safety and benefits of cannabis and break what Sanjay Gupta called 70 years of intentional misleading information. Those are all good points. And, of course, Obama can't be expected to show the leadership to take any of those steps. And at minimum, he needs to call off the dogs of the U.S. attorneys who were benign about medical pot during the first 3 years of his presidency, and then gearing up for his reelection, they started to crack down on pot dispensaries in California to try to win votes in Colorado, which went ahead and legalized it, way ahead of California. So it's time to end these stupid games. The cost to our society and to human beings for the war on some drugs, it's obscene. And as D'Angelo has just pointed out, this president could do a lot to change that, and almost overnight. When you hear about the exposure of wrongdoing by our intelligence communities in the Nixon era, you most often hear about Senator Frank Church and his commission. But there was also an important commission in the House of Representatives, chaired by Otis G. Pike, who died on Monday at the age of 92. He was a congressman from Long Island, spent 18 years in the House of Representatives, and in 1975 he became chairman of the House Select Committee on Intelligence, and he did a very good job of exposing wrongdoing by the CIA. He paid a price for it. He was considered to be an enemy of the national security state. I consider him a courageous defender of our Constitution and our personal rights. And finally today, a courageous DJ and waiter at a fancy restaurant called Tramshed in London screwed up his courage, went over to a table where former Prime Minister Tony Blair was dining with family members and friends, put his hand on the former British PM, and placed him under citizen's arrest for his role in leading Britain into our misadventure in Iraq. The man who deserves our credit here is a guy named Twiggy Garcia. He's described as a waiter, a DJ, and an aspiring producer. Garcia says his heart rate increased when he discovered Blair's eerie presence at the restaurant. He feared that Blair's security detail might have overheard him saying to a co-worker, "Should I citizens arrest him?" So Garcia said, here's how he made his move. He was sitting at the head of a table upstairs in the restaurant with about eight other people eating dinner. I went over to him, put my hand on his shoulder, and said, "Mr. Blair, this is a citizen's arrest for a crime against peace, namely your decision to launch an unprovoked war against Iraq. I am inviting you to accompany me to a police station to answer the charge." Well, I think this is a beautiful effort at citizen justice. And according to the Guardian newspaper, Tony Blair responded by arguing with him about Syria, saying, "I think you should be more concerned about Syria, to be honest." Garcia said he wasn't impressed. "I didn't expect him to start debating with me. I think he actually believed the lies that were coming out of his mouth." Twiggy Garcia, World Citizen of the Day. Thanks for speaking up for me. Thanks for joining me for news and comment. You're authorized to share this podcast with absolutely everyone, including Tony Blair. I'm Peter B.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.